Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
So that people can wake up and understand that money has no nutritional value, never has and never will, and that the natural order of things is what works to sustain us. And we better rise up to the occasion and understand that time is of the essence. So business as usual is over. People that think that, you know, we're going to remain the status quo, well, then you know what? Then they better quit having kids, because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see where we're headed.
That's Gunnisom Dear, a Mohawk citizen, linguist, spiritual leader, who recently spent a few days at Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, where a confrontation of worlds has occurred that you're probably very well familiar with. You can tell from his comments that this confrontation isn't just about water. In fact, it's emblematic of the confrontation that we're all involved with in the colliding of global finance and the prospect of global civilization collapse. Today we're going to delve into these concerns from a couple of different perspectives here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Chair of the Public Banking Institute, and Ellen's co-host, welcoming you back to the program once again as we take a year-end look at perhaps the most important issue of our age. Will the private control of money continue to undermine the sustenance and even the survival of our species? Will we manage to redirect the wayward ship of humanity to a place where we can hope for a long-term future? We'll be hearing a lot about that from one of our tribal elders, MIT's Noam Chomsky, later on in the program, as he speaks to high school age kids in Missouri in unequivocally frightening terms for those willing to accept his assessment. His observations illustrate the interplay that we focus on here: the rights of the people, the impact of money on policy and practice, and the dangerous path that we find ourselves on. We should all keep in mind that Chomsky, at 90 years of age, is one of the most highly regarded intellects and academics of our time. We'll also visit with another aged wisdom, the wisdom of the native people, who have lived here far longer than we, and who have suffered mightily at the hand of private capital avarice, a characteristic of the citizens of nations around the world, including our own. We are misoriented on this planet, according to our native brothers and sisters. We see serving only ourselves is the reason for living, whereas native peoples everywhere know that they belong to the planet. And how does that look in practice? Well, the Standing Rock demonstrations against the construction of yet another pipeline for oil and gas represents the core confrontation of ruling economic paradigms. One that says that money is the primary driver and product of power and value, and the other that points to the fact that any system of money is worthless if it doesn't act in harmony with nature and the people. At least it's unsustainable. Staying on the Dakota pipeline issue and the fight for water by people and money interests, we visit with someone who recently presented to the World Water Summit in Budapest, Hungary, which was discussing not only the dramatically growing need for water, but how we plan on financing the water systems that are needed for the future. Our guest is Gwen Hallsmith of Global Community Initiatives, and she too had a personal role in the Dakota Access Pipeline issue and brings forward a financing methodology that Ellen has been discussing for a while now. Simply create the money. So let's talk with Ellen now, take a look at some of the other current issues that are causing havoc in the community of people around the world, focusing this time on Italy, just the next domino to possibly fall in the European Union scenario of private money control ruling over democratic needs and interests. We discussed Standing Rock, observing that the Public Bank of North Dakota got implicated in the issue because it had to provide financing for the police and military response.
the bigger question is, should we be doing pipelines at all? You know,
that's true. But the fact that it's funded by the Bank of North Dakota, I don't think is a black mark
against the Bank
of North Dakota. It's just a bank. I mean, it's just like if the owner of your company tells you to do something, the owner is the state. The owner wants a loan. What's the bank going to do? It's like, oh, sorry, we don't believe in your cause. And it's not like one of their discretionary loans. They're there for emergencies. If the state needs the money for an emergency, that's probably in their mandate. I mean, I haven't read the specific paragraph, but I mean, they're probably just doing their job. That's what they're supposed to do.
Interesting. We had a contact in Minneapolis this week. Two of the city council people brought in the need to look for alternatives to the Wells Fargo situation. And ironically, it gets to be very, very ironic, Wells Fargo is Minneapolis's bank, but it's also the hometown of Wells Fargo in its previous iteration, when it was Northwestern Bank or something, some name like that. And that was the bank that was apparently active in North Dakota that was ripping off the farmers.
Oh, interesting. See, I saw it too. Did you see that thing where, I know that at one point the North Dakotans refused to allow the big pharmacies in?
Yes.
And now they've refused to let the big ag in.
Yes.
I think that's really cool that they can do a referendum. I mean, apparently the legislature had let them in, and then the people did an initiative and said, nope, we don't want them. And they booted them out.
That's a very interesting point, talking about local control. But here we have another emergence in the European frontier of trouble with the banking thing and no local control and no option. You've got to, you've got to take the money away from the people to balance our books. What's going on with Italy, Ellen?
Well, it seems the Italian banks, a number of the Italian banks, are completely insolvent. They have huge non-performing loans, in other words, loans that they can't collect on. So they need a bailout. But in order to get a bailout, the new EU rules as of January say that they have to first do a bail-in, which means they have to take the money of their bondholders and, if need be, going right down to the depositors, or their creditors in general, stockholders, bondholders, and depositors. And one problem is that the bondholders in this case are the little people. These are people that were fraudulently, or at least misrepresented to them, what they were buying. So they didn't know that they were the risk they were taking. That they thought they were just buying something like CDs or a savings account, just putting their money somewhere where it would make a little interest. And in fact, as bondholders, they're creditors, which means if the borrower doesn't pay, then you're out of luck. You don't get your money back. There were four little banks that they tried this on a year ago. I wrote about it then, where one man actually committed suicide because they had taken his whole 100,000 euro savings. So they took all his money. So that's even worse than the Cyprus bail-in, where they took 50% of the depositors who had more than 100,000 euros in the bank. So that was more than the insured deposit cutoff. So I guess the difference is, if you're a bondholder, you're a creditor of a bankrupt company, and so you just don't get your money back. So it's 100% for these bondholders, and these are people that don't deserve to lose their money. They really didn't know the risk they were taking. In fact, it seems to me you could argue that it's ex post facto. I mean, it was a law that was probably made after they bought those bonds. They probably bought them long ago, like the man who hung himself. At that time, they weren't all that risky, and then the EU came along and changed the law. So the EU, the European Commission in Brussels, is insisting that they do the bail-in before the bail-out, and that the Italian government is pleading to let them just do the bail-out. They want to just come up with the money. It's like 15 billion euros, I think, they need to bail out their banks. But what I wrote about in my article was that there's actually another alternative, but not everybody's ignoring this. And it was, I mean, it's not just a hypothetical alternative. It was brought up by Goldman Sachs. They said, here's what you can do. But they didn't do it, which is to do exactly what the Federal Reserve did in the same situation, bail out the banks by buying their non-performing loans off the books of the banks. That was their first quantitative easing, where the Fed bought the mortgage-backed securities off the books of the banks. And everybody knew, I mean, they weren't called toxic, but everybody knew they were toxic, that these were loans that the banks probably wouldn't be able to collect on, and they couldn't sell these securities. There was no market for them, and so the Fed bought them, and that allowed the banks to operate. And of course, we were all up in arms at the time. You know, I mean, everybody was writing about how bad that was, that here the big banks got a bailout, and where's our bailout? We, the little people who lost our homes or whatever. But the good of it was it did save the banking system. And as we know, banks create our money. And if we don't have those big money center banks, we would have a collapsed economy just like we had in the Great Depression. If they create the credit that makes the wheels of production go around, and if we don't have the credit, we won't have an economy. So it was good in that sense. Federal Reserve did indeed save the system, and the ECB could do the same thing. And they must know that because the Fed did it, and it's been done before historically. So it seems to me they could do that. Why didn't they do it? Arguably, Richard Werner thinks, and a number of other people think, that it's including like Bill Engdahl, or William Engdahl, who we've interviewed, that the ECB, the EC, that what used to be called the Troika, they actually want to force the countries into debt servitude, so they'll be forced to form a political union, which is what the EU was supposed to be all about. They did the monetary union first, with everybody knowing that you couldn't really share a currency unless you shared a government, the thought being that the countries would be forced into sharing a government. But these countries are also different. They really don't want a single government. It's like having the United States, having all these states not being part of the United States, but we'd still be using the dollar. I mean, the reason it works for the United States is that we're all one government, and Washington looks out for our individual interests, et cetera.
So what you're saying is that the global bank interests that are running the European Central Bank and the European Commission are wanting to get rid of the little guys and consolidate it into one controllable mega structure of governance.
Right, and that structure is not elected. They're unelected bureaucrats, so their big corporate interests are running the show, and that's what they want. But it seems to me the ultimate answer, I mean, I hate to be on the side of endorsing big bailouts by the central bank for the big banks, but that's better than the alternative, which is to let the economy collapse. But the ultimate solution is bail out the banks and nationalize them, or make sure that they're public utilities serving the public interest. So we'll save them, but instead of letting them go on their merry way, as the Fed did in 2009 and 10 and so forth, there should be conditions imposed, namely, hereafter you serve the public interest.
Yeah, so once again, it comes back to who controls the issuance of the money, whether or not things get worked out in the favor of the little guy, or even the little guy, even in this case, being the country of Italy. Talking about Greece a couple of years ago, about how those people also, their economy is completely tanked as well. Well, it's all over the world, the austerity issue.
And I read somewhere that the difference was Greece wants to stay in the Eurozone, European Union, and they'll do it at any cost, and that's why they could be coerced into this arrangement. But the Italians aren't that way. If the people rebel against this government, which they well could, if there's a massive bail-in that's not fair to the bondholders, then the five-star movement could get in, and they would change the government. So it could be interesting. They could trigger mass exodus from the EU, although apparently it's a younger generation of five-star movement, and they've sort of modified their position because they want to prove that they can actually, you know, they're not just swearing cowboys, they can actually manage a government. So they might not go so far as to leave the union, but anyway, some dramatic things could be happening. We've given the other side a chance, and it's just come, like in Italy, it's just come to more bailouts. Those banks have already been bailed out, and now they're asking for another bailout. So when does it end? It'll just be one bailout after another unless we actually change the system. So people are actually looking for alternatives now that might work.
Well, we'll see what happens next, Ellen.
Yes.
Stay tuned.
Well, I'll be watching.
I know you will, thankfully. Figure it out for us. So, Happy New Year, Ellen.
Oh, thanks, and Happy New Year to you. I'm looking forward to it, whatever may transpire.
It'll give you something to write about, that's for sure.
Right.
Water has been called the new oil. though I'm sure we all hope it doesn't fall into the same hands that have ravaged the environment for oil. There may not be much hope for that idea, though, since the major banks, water companies, and other profiteers are already very busy figuring out how to get their hands on it, even as the supplies are sullied and diminished by commerce, mining, and a host of other players. Let's talk with Gwen Hall-Smith, the executive director of Global Community Initiatives, who is in Budapest, Hungary, meeting with people from the world over, focusing on the future of water.
You recently returned from the World Water Summit. This being a program about money, would you put the two together for us?
Sure. Well, I was asked to speak at the Water Summit on how to ensure fair and affordable access to water by all the world's citizens and others that need it. You know, it's not just people that need water, of course. Forests and animals and plants need it too. And yet, that is one of the biggest problems on the planet, is that people don't have access to safe water. Billions of people don't have access to safe water. I mean, think about that. I'm sure you get up in the morning and you make your coffee and you take a shower and you use all the things that you do, all the things you do with water, and you don't even think about it twice. We take it for granted. It's something that's in the background of our lives that, you know, cleans up everything, every mess we make, and keeps us healthy and well. But think about being somebody that doesn't have access to it at all. Like, even in Europe, some of the cities I worked with in Bulgaria, for example, only had the water on in their buildings a couple days a week. And they'd have to, like, draw a big bathtub full and save it for when they needed it later. And that's luxury compared to people that end up having to walk 5 miles each time they need a bucket of water. One of the rallying cries around this issue globally was that everybody should have water available to them within 15 minutes. Wow. You know, when you walk to your sink the next time and turn it on, think about that. So water access is an enormous issue. And of course, one of the biggest obstacles to water access is money. And yet, money is a social construct that we all know is inequitably distributed and inequitably controlled around the planet. And so what I was invited to speak about was what changes in the monetary system itself might help solve this problem of water access. Now, certainly places that have public banks, like Germany, if they have infrastructure projects and they need financing for them on a local level, the public banks in Germany are probably able to help with that. But more than that, there have been long periods of history when people and governments have issued money into existence for the construction of infrastructure. So that the only way that money comes into existence isn't through the lending that's done by all of the banks, including public banks, but government basically prints it into existence by paying for the work that's done to build water services and sewer plants and schools and hospitals and universities and bridges and roads and all the things that government builds that makes our economy run. In fact, as recently as 1981, that was happening in the United States. As recently as like 2004, it was happening in Britain through this thing called the Ways and Means Advance. Certain countries like the little Channel Islands in between Britain and France have used that technique for many years. And interestingly enough, speaking of Britain, in Britain for like 800 years, that was largely the way government issued money into existence, through these things called tally sticks, which were sticks that were split so that when the grains matched and they came back together, they knew that they weren't counterfeit. And notches were made in the sticks before they were split, denominating how much they were worth. Because, of course, you had to pay taxes to the government, and the government would pay you for your road work with one of these sticks, and then when you needed to pay taxes, you'd get it back. That worked for 800 years in Britain as one way of issuing money into existence. It wasn't the only way, but it was one very effective way. And interestingly enough, in the 1800s, when the Bank of England decided that system really had to go because they could make a lot more money lending the money to the government rather than having the government continue to have the ability just to make their own, They decided to burn the tally sticks in the basement of Parliament, and the ensuing fire burned the entire building down. So that tells you something about what happens to democracy when we allow the banks to take over our money system. That's one of my favorite little tales. But I was actually talking about that. Yeah, that we should go back to tally sticks, essentially, and start issuing money into existence through the construction of infrastructure for water and sewer services so that people have access to safe drinking water and sanitary waste disposal systems. There's nothing at all stopping governments from doing this. It's a perfectly legitimate and legal thing to do. The only thing that stops people and governments from doing this is the dominant paradigm of privately owned money and banking, which is essentially a false neoliberal narrative that keeps us all enslaved to this whole debt-making system, frankly. But you started to see the cracks in Britain. Positive Money UK is calling for this, and other organizations around the world are starting to wake up to the fact that, wow, we could invent this differently. And so I think there's some hope that people will see the light and will be able to issue money in new ways to give people access to the government services they need.
Like water. Of course, we can understand that that money gets involved with the water of Detroit and Flint and Newark and hundreds, if not thousands, of cities around the U.S. where there's not enough money to get water to the people. But in other countries, it's also a new investment frontier, isn't it? Water.
Yeah, it is, of course. And one of the people that were on the panel with me was this prince from Benin, who ran Black Lion Investments, and he was talking about getting investors involved in water, which essentially adds up to privatizing what should be a public good. And I know it's a really popular thing to do, but it's a very dangerous thing to do, you know, because the problem is that investors expect a return on their investment. So not only are you expected to pay the money back that they've essentially put into your system someday, but you got to do that with interest. So the money that's generated from any surplus that comes out of a public water supply, or what used to be a public water supply, goes into private pockets, and that eliminates its ability to pay the employees higher or make for more research and development or system expansion and improvement. I mean, all of those things are then made, those decisions are made with investors' interests in mind. And the data shows, I mean, this has been happening for the last 20 years, and World Water Watch did a study on it a little while ago and showed, just in the United States, the differences between the privatized water systems and the public water systems. And on average, private systems charge their customers 59% more for their rates, and the quality was not better. It was worse. So you're paying more for lower quality stuff, and it's essentially at the UN level, at this point in history, water is considered a human right. Now, a human right should be exempt from privatization. I mean, think about it. Another right we have is our freedom of speech. So I'm talking to you completely frankly and honestly right now, and right now this is one of my constitutionally protected rights. Now, what if I had to pay somebody every time I opened my mouth because that right had somehow been privatized and this company now was the one that owned my right to free speech, and so I needed to pay for it? That's essentially what we're doing when we're privatizing water, when we have decided on a global level that water is a human right.
And the people in poor countries or in overcrowded countries with under supply of water are out of luck unless they can come up with the cash.
Right, and increasing amounts of cash, too. You know, one of the things that caused the riots in Ecuador and Bolivia when Bechtel went in there and privatized their water system was they jacked up the rates to places that people couldn't afford. I think it was Bolivia. They actually made it illegal for the people to gather rainwater from their roofs for some of their needs in their houses. Bechtel claims that since it was water and they owned the water in that region, that they owned the rain that fell on these people's houses. So they were really angry, and there were riots in the streets and people killed. The government subsequently deprivatized. It didn't kick Bechtel out, which was a good idea, but it took death and huge amounts of nonviolent civil disobedience before they did that.
But and there are places, there are states in the west, on the western part of the U.S., where you're not allowed to collect your rainwater because of, I think, recharge issues. Hydrological recharge.
But that would be a legal constraint, not a privatized company constraint.
True. Very good. Yeah. So, what did the World Water Summit conclude? What did they arrive at? And how are we fixed with water for our future?
Well, there is a long list of recommendations that I'd be happy to send you. I was a little disappointed looking at through the official policy document, which was what the governments would have arrived at, that the passage that I did manage to get inserted into the civil forum document about, you know, we should explore public money for public infrastructure wasn't in there anywhere, which was kind of a bummer, but that's partially because these summits run on several tracks, and I was speaking in the civil forum, and so in that forum, they did add that conclusion to the document, and it didn't somehow percolate up to the big forums document, but that's not a big surprise because, of course, when you looked around the summit and you saw all these huge water companies represented in the expo and banks and others that support those water companies represented, somebody that was saying, oh, excuse me, there is another way to do this. Probably wasn't terribly popular.
I see.
But, you know, one of the interesting things was that after my talk, several people that had listened to it came chasing me out of the room and really wanted to know more because they'd never actually even heard of what I had been, they'd never heard that it was possible for governments to issue money into existence for the construction of infrastructure. That was completely new to them. Of course, you know, it's a UN process. A lot of them are valid and valuable, but I think until we tackle the problem of the monetary system, they will continue to be out of our reach because they are considered unaffordable.
Right. All in the context of money being a private
commodity.
Yeah. Yep.
Money is like the central issue.
Yeah.
All of the goals that are set could easily be done if we have a different way of dealing with money.
And that leads also to what's really the real economy that we live in, which is the planet. And the demonstrations at Standing Rock, of course, giving remarkable witness to that importance. I know you had friends who were there.
Oh, yeah, especially during the Water Summit. I had about 30 friends that were out there while I was in Budapest. And I think we talked a little bit about the interview I did with James Dalton while I was in Budapest, because he was there. He was the Civil Works Director for the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the division that's responsible for both the permits and the easements that they needed to run that pipeline.
So obviously, they got some results. I don't suppose we can expect them to hold.
I think we can. The exciting thing about the ruling that came out a few days later, the ruling came out from his boss, which is the Assistant Secretary of Civil Works. The woman who made the announcement would have been the person Obama appointed to be the political director of that division. And what she required as part of her determination was that an environmental impact statement be done. An environmental impact statement basically forces an applicant who wants to proceed with a project that involves federal lands, federal permits, or federal money. That's required by law. You have to do an environmental impact statement, and that environmental impact statement has to include an analysis of the alternatives to the project that you're proposing.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard, for example, that the pipeline had originally been scheduled to go through a white area, a white, more suburban area, closer to the Anglo population, where the crossing of the river was much, much shorter, you know, sort of a river width crossing. Here, they're drilling under this lake, so this pipeline has to go like a mile under this lake in a river that has many other places where it's a lot less wide. You know, so that increases the risk of accident and inability to fix it dramatically, especially in a place where it's frozen solid this time of year. And, you know, 17 million people downstream, not just the Native Americans. This is what the news seems to want to tell you. 17 million people downstream depend on that river for their water supply. You know, so here we are at the Water Summit, and I'm saying, you know, this is about water. You're allowing this project to go forward using your land and your permits. Apparently, the way they avoided having to do an environmental impact statement was by trying to cut up the project in so many pieces that it never quite reached some threshold. One had never been done. I was absolutely astounded to learn that the day the announcement came out, that there hadn't been an EIS. And that's part of the reason he couldn't answer most of my questions.
No.
And so she And so the assistant secretary has now declared that an EIS is required. It's current law that that's required. I mean, like I said, they were breaking the law in a kind of sleazy way to avoid doing it. They would have to change a whole raft of laws relatively quickly to get out of having to produce an EIS on this project. Now, maybe they'll just ignore the law. That's a possibility. But if they are ignoring it, then that gives the legal beagles that are out there really concerned about the environment some real hooks to go to court and make them stop.
So you see how upside down our values, you know, upside down in terms of the natural resources, of, you know, the importance of water being undermined by the system of capital investment, and the importance of people's health undermined by a system of profiteering. These are interesting days, and it's a very pivotal time, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like the peak moment. Really, we have come to a place where the very, very small majority that control the vast majority of wealth are hitting the wall themselves. And that's why you're seeing these kind of developments, because where does creeping privatization come from, except from the fact that there aren't many places anymore that profit is easily made? So they need to find new areas where profit can be made. And, oh, my God, something that everybody on the planet and every fish and every plant needs, oh, that's a profit center for sure, because nobody can go without it. If you can control it and you can make money off it, you're golden. Of course, the fact that that's violating our human rights ought to come into that particular equation, but that takes resistance and that takes protest.
Well, Gwen, I want to thank you very much for joining us and for sharing these experiences and these insights. It's really interesting that what we've inherited is a dead-end, unsustainable system of monetization of everything valuable. And this is something, I suppose, that will characterize the days ahead as well as the struggle ahead. Thanks, Gwen.
Yeah, thank you, Walt. Great to talk to you.
That's Gwen Hall-Smith, Executive Director of Global Community Initiatives. Now, we're pleased to share a visit, a very special visit, with ancient tribal wisdom, as conveyed through the words and thoughts of a Mohawk spiritual leader and linguist, a teacher, Gunnasoam Dir, who lives in Canada, but recently spent a couple days at the Standing Rock demonstration in North Dakota. Now, you might wonder why we'd be talking with a spiritual leader about the mundane dimensions of money, but when you later hear from Noam Chomsky as he lays out the prospects for our planet and our kind, our species, you'll get the context. And what's typical about the way that we think about these things is that we don't connect these two dimensions of ourselves, our lives, our communities, that the essential economic system we live in is operated by the planet that we inhabit. There are no exceptions. No monetary cleverness or ledger domain is going to change the fact that we're on a path that we don't control, and that many of us would rather not even acknowledge.
We're at a crisis point now. We're also at a tipping point. If we don't get a handle on our relationship to our mother, the Earth, and how we're supposed to act and be, well, as a human being, we're the most vulnerable. You know, even though people walk around with these inflated egos, thinking that man is above nature, well, you know what? We're the biggest babies. When it gets too cold, we complain. When it gets too hot, we complain. We get too much rain, we complain. And we're going to find out that we're going to be the first to be gone if we don't smarten up. And we're at that point now where we're beginning to see that, you know, the ecosystems are being stressed. There's animal extinctions that is happening. We have all kind of new diseases now and sicknesses that we never had before. And all of this is all attributed to human beings not understanding their right relationship to the natural world. And as I said, we're at a critical point now, and what's all accumulating now in Standing Rock is all of these things converging now again to bring this indigenous wisdom and knowledge to the forefront so that people can wake up and understand that money has no nutritional value, never has and never will, that the natural order of things is what works to sustain us, and we better rise up to the occasion and understand that, you know, time is of the essence. Business as usual is over. And for people that think that, you know, we're going to remain the status quo, well, then you know what? Then they better quit having kids, because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see where we're headed. What we're doing is not just only for us, but it's for the entire world. You know, maybe people don't understand it, what this is all about. And really what it's all about, too, is that our freedoms and our privileges are all been taken away. You know, there's a real famous Native activist, and he's online on YouTube, Russell Means, and one of the things that he was talking about, he says, you know what the biggest reservation is in the United States today? It's the United States. Because everything that the government have done to our people, now they're doing it to their own people, whether they realize it and see it or not. But all their liberties, their freedoms are being taken away through their administrative process. And now, you know, they're feeling the pinch because, you know, there's people that have three jobs. They're trying to keep themselves afloat. And it doesn't matter how much they try to get ahead. It's like the deck is stacked against them. And even like, you know, the people's lifeblood is being sucked out of them. So now we have to come together and ask ourselves, individuals, intellectuals that understand what's happening, and say, all right, so what are we going to do different? And what we have to do different is we have to look at the root of all of these causes, and it's all monetary. So now when we understand money, now we have to look at, all right, so how do we get in this mess? Where are we now, and how are we getting out of here? So we have to look at monetary reform. Prior to 3 years ago, you think I gave diddly squat about monetary reform or economic reform. Only thing that I know is this is our house. People from across the great saltwater came in it, destroyed it, put us on reserve, did all this different kinds of stuff, and now I'm an economic slave. Like, how the heck did that happen? You know, but it happens because of this superior attitude and thinking that says that we don't matter, we don't count. We're the ruling power. We have the answers to everything, and we're going to subjugate you whether you like it or not. So get outside and just, you know, go with the flow, so to speak. But we know that we're on a runaway train. The crash is going to happen at some point in time. And some of us, like you, me, you individuals that know that we have to look at a new economic model, you know, are trying to say, well, what could we do before the crash? So this is where we are.
Could you say a bit more about what kind of monetary reform you think needs to happen?
Going back to our Constitution, around 1752 or thereabouts, the Albany Plan asked a delegation from the Iroquois Confederacy chiefs to make a presentation. And there was a famous Mohawk chief by the name of Gunasadego who led the gathering about sharing about our Constitution, our great laws of peace, and how our government works. And our government is based on the whole idea that, you know, there's no hierarchy. Even though we have people that are put in positions like chiefs and clan mothers and the ceremonial and social fabric of the people, it's everybody working together. You know, and the chiefs always put the needs and the affairs of their people first. So the chiefs are usually the last ones to eat. You know, they make sure that all of their people's needs are met. Then they come and will have whatever is left. You know, that's what leadership is about. Because what are you leadership for? You're not there for yourself. You're there for the people. So the people's needs always come first. But how is it now in government? You know, where you have fat cats who make these huge, enormous salaries. But then you have their own people that are out on the street with no food, no clothing, no whatever. And, you know, the whole argument to say, well, you know, it's their fault. You know, whatever caused people to get in their hardship, we don't judge them according to that. The thing is, they need help. And, you know, we have to rise to the occasion and to help them. So getting back to the founding fathers and the Constitution, so then they took some of those ideas and then, you know, formulated their own Constitution and their own democracy. You know, when Trump talks about America being great again, America had the opportunity to be great. You know, if it would have embraced the great laws of peace, our constitution, with women having a voice, with no hierarchy, with ensuring that the people's needs come first and all of that. But what they did was they just kind of changed it where it didn't work to the best of its ability. So you know what? America had the chance to be great. But now if you look at the history of what has happened, how we were treated, put on reservations, the Trail of Tears, infested blankets, and we can go on and on and on. You know, and when you look and you reflect back on that history, how could you really say that you've been great? Well, the people that believe that are walking around with blinders on and don't see the truth of what really happened. So now here we are, all of this time later now, and there's things that are coming back now, you know, to bite us in the rear. And as a result of us not being true human beings with each other, so now we're going to end up suffering the consequences, and it's happening on many levels. But in spite of it all, you know, we still have to put our collective mind together and say, okay, so what are we going to do different? So based on our peacemaker, who was a prophet that came and established our government, you know, one of the things that he talked about was the notion of the one dish with one spoon. And what he said was that we would not argue anymore about territorial boundaries, that the land, the resources, the fish, the game, the animals, all of those things that sustained us, because that was kind of like, quote unquote, the money, but from a natural perspective, so we all, quote, equally have a right to it. That's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to understand that there's a direct connection between the physical world and the spiritual world. And then the great tree. We can't have life without trees because they give us wood for all of our homes, supplies us with some of the air, oxygen that we need to survive, heats our homes, it places for the animals, the birds, trees, and that connects us to the soil. The soil, which is the skin of the Mother Earth. And then we have the white roots of peace, so that anybody that wants to sit under the great tree, if they have good thoughts, good words, good actions, then they're welcome to sit underneath that great tree. And those white roots of peace go to the, you know, the four directions, north, east, west, and south. What should happen is we should have, where it's we the people, you know, there's no ruling elites, there's no multi-corporations that are going to put profits over people, but it's we the people. So then all of these people that have this kind of mind, we would establish this world, indigenous world bank, where it would stand for three principles. Number one, world peace. Because we know that war is a business, you know, and there's people that profit off of that. People in the world that are sick of it. So we're saying that if we could establish another kind of institution that would stand for world peace. Number two, earth stewardship. You know, what are we going to do to clean up the lakes, the waters, the streams, the forests, all of these contaminants that we're doing? And then number three, let's eradicate global poverty. Because with the amount of wealth that exists in the world today, there's no reason why there are still people that are, you know, starving, that don't have their basic necessities met. And that's happening, like, even here in Canada, United States. You know, you look at some of the reservations. I mean, you know, all of these things were stolen from us. There's people that have gotten filthy rich off of our backs. And then they never think twice to say, but all of this rich and wealth that I've accumulated, where did it actually come from? You know, it didn't come from Europe. A lot of the stuff came from the resources that people stole, exploited. And then now, you know, there's still people that are disadvantaged because people came in and tried to do all these different kinds of stuff. So let's eradicate global poverty. So those were the three principles that I said, you know, that this bank would stand for. So again, world peace, environmental stewardship, and eradicating global poverty. And then once we establish it, because we are sovereign people, that sovereignty and nationhood comes from our great spirit. There's nobody in this world that can say that we cannot do this. We can. We just have to get our minds around it, get knowledgeable about monetary reform like myself. And that's why I presented this idea. Now, I says, all of the people that are of this mindset, if we put our collective money together and we started to work on this, then instead of that money getting bled out, that goes back to Wall Street. So then that money that interest payments comes back and then work for the state as opposed to getting bled off. So now in this World Bank, instead of it feeding the fat cats and Wall Street and all of those people, what happens is we just say, look, we're smart enough to pool all our collective money together, and then let's let this money work for us together as a global people, as opposed to the status quo that exists right now, where it's just people in Wall Street and the bankers and the rich that keep getting richer, and we keep getting poorer and poorer. Now I'm starting to talk about our own Iroquois Confederacy government and get our own leadership in there to start understanding these ideas and these concepts, because for the most part, a lot of these issues about monetary reform are new. So now what's happening is, with all of these things culminating together, there's people now that are starting to understand that in order for us now to take the next step, we have to get our mind around monetary reform and start seriously looking at that, because then we could have all the monies that we need to fund different projects, different things that we talk about, because, it's right for the time, let's just put it that way. You know, the way we've kind of been seduced now to be part of this economic engine, whether we like it or not, you know, because of the people at the top who were pulling the strings and determining the direction of where everything is going. So now, like it or not, we all become these slaves. So now people do these jobs. But when we ask ourselves, but all of these jobs, which one are really benefiting the community to say that it's helping us to become more morally right or more environmentally conscious and all these different kinds of stuff? If we begin to ask ourselves those questions and then begin to retool, there wouldn't be this need for people to be stuck in traffic every day and doing all these different kinds of stuff. If we put all of our collective minds and thinking together, we would need to be doing all of this oil and traveling and stuck in traffic and all of that. You know, we could start retooling and looking at how to make cities more environmentally sound, how we get off of fossil fuels, how we look at these different kind of energies. There's so many things that we could employ people in different ways, but there has to be some leniency here. You know, if people lost their jobs for whatever reason, don't come down hard on them and throw them out on the street. You know, give them 3 years. Say, look, go back to school. Don't worry about your mortgage payment. We're not going to charge you additional interest. Just go back to school, get retooled, do these different kinds of stuff. But, you know, the governments have to be, how would you say, like, have love and compassion for their people. But the way the system is right now, it doesn't. Because the minute you fall back in arrears or something like that, the next thing you know, you're out. Now, this indigenous bank that I'm talking about would have that type of a heart, love and compassion for its people. The whole idea is not to say that, you know, you come down hard. You give them this flexibility. You know, credit cards, instead of being 21% interest, why? You know, let's give it at 5% interest payments for housing instead of 8%, whatever they charge. You know, you come from this place of love and compassion where it's not profits over people. You put your people first. So there's all of these different kinds of stuff that we could do, and we could create this whole new beautiful environment. Then what happens is then people would all of a sudden know that they're valued. There wouldn't be all of this crime. There wouldn't be all of this hate, because people are so stressed, the system that they're in today, that that's why you have all of this murder and conflict, and because people's spirits have been wounded. And when they're wounded, they're walking around hurt like everybody else. Nobody wants to walk around in pain. So then you get the alcoholism, you get the drugs, you get people that are now addicted to all of these painkillers and opiates and all this different kinds of stuff. And it's never going to get better until the people that are in power understand and see that the system that they've created is over. Business as usual is over. We got to put our best collective thinking forward now and ask, what can we do better? And we still have an opportunity. There's still time left. But people that make all of these decisions and all of that, they have to come to the realization, too, that they have grandkids. And even though they're trillionaires and billionaires, money doesn't bring happiness either. Because there's so much hurt and pain in the world today, you know, there's people that are going to react in ways that are not positive ways. And at the same time, you know, there's a lot of people that, because of them being economic slaves and having to pay their bills because the governments and a lot of the banks have no heart, so then that causes a lot of people, too, to have no heart. So there's going to be this shift. And as much as a baby, when it's being born, it's a beautiful thing that happens when the birth of that child, but the mother goes through some intense labor and pain. There's going to be some pain and some hardship in what's happening here on many levels. But as much as there's going to be pain and hardship, the flip side of that is there is this new birthing that is happening. And we're in this time now where, as much as it's great to be alive, there's some things too that we're going to experience that we're not going to like. But when everything is all said and done, we still have to come from the position that every human being, as Joseph Campbell says in his book, The Power of Myth, when you look at another human being, you have to look at that other human being as a thou. And a thou is another word for God. The whole purpose of war and conflict sometimes is when you come from a place of ego, is to look at your opponent as a it. When you look at that person as an it, then it means that you think that you're superior to them, that you can destroy them in any way that you feel, either physically, spiritually, emotionally, whatever, as opposed to this idea of coming from the place of thou. And when people really get that and understand it, you can never go to war again against your fellow human being, because you know, slay another human being is to slay God, and nobody wants to slay their own creator or great spirit. So this is some of the philosophy and the thinking and the understanding that we have to come through. And hopefully people that are going to be listening to this will come to this mindset that, you know, we're all in this together. The conflict and war, we have to eliminate that. We have to come from love, peace, and compassion and work together, because all of our lives are at stake now.
That's Gunnisoam Deer of the Mohawk tribe of the Iroquois Confederacy talking about our common essential human economics. And now I want to share this brief commentary from one of our tribal leaders, Noam Chomsky, speaking to a gathering of high schoolers in Missouri earlier this year. He's a little hard to hear, being over 90 years old, but it's worth the effort. And with this commentary, you'll see how all of this fits together.
We are living at a unique moment in the whole history of the human species. Its seriousness and significance, it can't be underestimated. You and your generation are going to have to make a decision now as to whether organized human life will continue on the earth. That's not an exaggeration. The environmental crisis is growing. It's inexorable. It's not going to stop. If concurrent tendencies continue in your lifetime, that of your children, the prospects for organized human existence will radically decline. It's not really controversial. Take a look at any issue of a science journal, every issue that comes along, it's a more grim forecast. We have already made this decision, incidentally, for other species. The current level of species extinction due to anthropogenic global warming, human-created global warming, is already at the level of the what's called the fifth extinction, 65 million years ago, when a huge asteroid hit the Earth, ended the age of the dinosaurs, opened a way for small mammals to exist, ultimately us. Now we're the asteroid. We're killing species at the level of the asteroid 65 million years ago, and we're next. It's not far off. Already 300 million people, not a small number, are facing death from lack of water in India after a drought, unprecedented drought that's been going on for years. It soon will be greater. Sea levels are predicted to rise within a few decades, not long, by maybe 3 to 6 feet. That'll be a disaster for coastal cities, but much worse than that, coastal plains like Bangladesh will be inundated. That's hundreds of millions of people fleeing, trying desperately to survive. If anyone thinks there's an immigration crisis now, just wait a couple of decades. It's plainly the rate of global warming is fast, far faster, hundreds of times faster than at any recorded time. All of this is happening. What's happening in the richest country in the world? To what extent is the most significant question in world history arising in the primary? Well, on the Democratic side, practically not at all. A few phrases now and then, but practically nothing. On the Republican side, it's raised a lot. It's denied. Every single Republican candidate says it's not happening. One exception, John Kasich. He said, yeah, it's happening, but we shouldn't do anything about it. That's even worse. So in other words, we have the richest, most powerful country in world history, which is saying loud and clear, let's race to the precipice as fast as we can and fall over it and make sure that within a short time, organized human life can't persist. That's the richest, most powerful country in the world. Let's go to the other extreme, Bolivia, the poorest country in South America. What's happening there? The opposite. When Bolivia is the one country that has the rights of survival as part of their legal system with very extensive efforts. That's the poorest country in the world. At the same time that Bolivia was, at the very same time, same month that Bolivia was instituting the strongest measures yet adopted anywhere to deal with the crisis, that same month, the Republican-run Congress in the United States blocked a resolution which simply said global warming is taking place. Not let's do anything about it. A resolution said it's taking place, blocked by the Republican Congress. That's the richest, most powerful country in the world, the poorest country in South America at the same time. What's the difference? The difference is that Bolivia has an indigenous majority, and the indigenous population has been able to use the its majority position to take a substantial amount of political power. And that's representative of what's happening all over the world. If there's ever a future historian, there may not be as matters are proceeding. Those historians will look back at this moment in time with absolute wonder. The richest, most powerful, most advanced, educated sectors in the world are saying, let's destroy ourselves. The indigenous populations everywhere are leading the struggle to try to do something about it. The First Nations in Canada, tribal groups in India, Australia, Bolivia, Ecuador, almost everywhere you look. That's the current situation. That's the kind of thing that's happening around the world. That's the situation which you're in. You and people like you are going to have to make the decision as to whether we pursue the course outlined by the power systems in the richest and most powerful countries in history, or whether we're going to listen to the indigenous populations, which both at the broad level, like Bolivia, and at the local level, like Santa Rita, are trying to do something about the future of the species.
Noam Chomsky. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.